For the final hour, Darren Donick and Chase here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Darren McFarland and Willie Donick here with you today. Chase is off for the week. He'll be back with us on Monday. Marquise Munson back at our Wholesale Link Game Studios, powered by RumbleOn.com. We now say hello and good afternoon to Hal Gill, a.k.a. Skillsy, hashtag Ask Hal. Hal, how you doing?
I'm doing great, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Good to hear your voice again. How are things as we inch a little bit closer to return to play?
Well, my kids have tried as hard as they could to kill me. but I made it through, I think, for the most part. We're coming out the other side, I hope. We got some sports going on in limited capacity, so that helps things out. But, yeah, I'm doing all right. I'm hanging in there. I'm excited to have hockey back. It was fun last week being at the rink and having something to do.
Yeah, no doubt. We were talking about
getting to see you, D-Mac. I got to see you. I haven't seen you in forever.
I was so happy to see you there as we kind of came into the arena together. That was awesome. It made my day, too. So thank you for that. That got me going that morning. We were talking about Peter Forsberg. It's his 47th birthday today. What was he like to play against?
Probably the most dynamic one. I'll put him top five most dynamic players I've ever played against. The physicality he brought with his skill was probably better. You know, there was a handful of guys that could do that, that could turn on a dime and blow right through your shoulder. You know, he was doing, you know, we've seen the Philip Forsberg reverse hit. That was invented by Peter Forsberg. And I had no idea it existed until I found out the hard way. And, you know, you're going, he's a skilled player. So you want to go in and for me, I wanted to establish myself as a physical dominance. And I'd go in thinking I'd poke it off him. And of course you're in Colorado and you're having a hard time breathing anyway. And then he'd turn around and blow his shoulder right through your chest. And more often than not, his helmet would be right in line with my chin. And so his helmet and his shoulder just exploded right through my body. And it was honestly the first time it happened to me, it was about a period and a half before I felt like I could breathe and felt like I could go back and play hockey. It was a struggle. But then at the same token, he's going out there scoring goals. He's not going out there thinking he's just going to go bang bodies. And so what do you do with a player like that? He was an anomaly. He was tough to play against. Talk about careers cut short and what he could have done if he had the longer time on the ice. It's kind of a shame.
Yeah. So I mean, you just talked about that. And so obviously that stood out. But, I mean he won so many awards. He's a Hall of Famer. So it was just one of those things. And, by the way you were describing him, is that – I guess here in the States, I know he's from Sweden, is it when we say he's country strong, is that the best way to put it for him? He was just country strong?
Farm boy strength. Some guys like that, I think, has a lot to do with being on their edges, and I feel like he was always on his edge, and with his foot problem, it took away from his game, and, that's when that's the strength of your game, it's tough to figure out how to play that way, and he put a lot of strain on it because he was so strong on his edges.
Well, Roman Josi has been named a finalist for the Norris Trophy. I don't think that's really going to get anybody falling out of their chair to hear that.
No but way, it is really?
I know. What?
No way.
You've got to be kidding me. Breaking news. But it is the first time it's happened in his career, and it has been made official. He's, the three finalists nobody to sneeze at, right? When you think about Carlson and Hedman along with Roman Josi, all three tremendous players and tremendous at what they do. But you see him and we see him game in and game out and in practice on every day. And still, you know, a lot of times, as you know, Hal, you can take people for granted if you're around them all the time and you don't realize how good they are, where observers from afar maybe appreciate them a little bit more, but that's not the case with him. I mean, even seeing him all the time, I think we appreciate him even more because of that, because we know how good he is.
Yeah, he just ripped a highlight reel goal in that little scrimmage or whatever they had in practice the other day. And, you know, of course, you know, he skates around guys and gets the puck and finds a scoring area. And, that's what he does so well. And, you know, the more you break down his game, the more you look at what he does, I don't think there's anyone better at, and this includes forwards. There's not too many guys that can go down the boards from the point and find a way into the slot and make things happen the way Roman has and does consistently and does when the team needs him. And that's the big thing for me is that, you know, Pete Weber was talking about it the other day. Is where would the Preds be without him? You know, without Roman and what he's done. And he's not just solid defensively. He's not getting his points just on the power play. He's had to work for everything he's gotten. The top six for the Preds haven't been as strong as they probably should have been or would have liked to have been. And he really drove the offense from the back end. So I just don't see as good as Hedman is. I don't think Hedman has had the year that Carlson and Yossi have had. And as good as Carlson is, I think he relies on his supporting staff so much. I really think you have to be, you have to look at Roman as the clear and favorite in my book. And it just, you know, you look at the way all the numbers don't lie. You know, Willie talks about all the numbers. He's been putting up the numbers, but really the eyeball test for me, watching him play, it's as good as it gets. And I just don't see him slowing down either. So this will be the first of many nominations, I hope. And I think he should win this one.
Yeah, that's right. He passed both tests, the stats test and the eyeball test. So that's a good category to be in. If you were, just to say you were a coach, and you had to sit here and all you're going to get is this training camp and then a scrimmage against Dallas on the 30th. But unusual set of circumstances where most teams are coming in, you know, completely healthy, which, you know, this time of year, Hal, when you're gearing up for the playoffs, it's just the opposite. I mean, you're sometimes it makes decisions for coaches even easier because there's just guys that can't go or there's injuries and that's not the case. So if everybody's upright and healthy and ready to go, it is going to create some tough decisions. How would you go about trying to figure out, you know, we talked so much through the course of the year about the third D pairing, and a lot of times it was by necessity, right? Because guys were banged up. But there are some interesting battles for ice time, right? And for roster time. And how do you go about doing that with just a training camp and a scrimmage?
Yeah, well, the hard part for me, and I'll cycle back to, you know, the fact that these coaches, there's a lot of unfit to plays right now, and you don't know, you know, you go into training camp or whatever we're calling this, if it is a training camp, you know, you're going to have some guys, hey, your groin's a little sore, why don't you sit out a practice, and, or, you know, with the way things are right now, we don't know, it's unfit to play, so I imagine it's scary for coaches going, I just got to go out there and throw my best hand out on the ice and see what we can get because the guys are coming in and going out. And there's some teams that are having problems right now where I just saw Boston has the majority of their guys on the ice. So that being said, as a coach, you want to, especially in this format, want to have a confident group going out. So I don't think you want to go out there and really test someone's position. And in the beginning of a season in October, when you're just starting up, sometimes you say, hey, you know, this guy is pushing for a job. He's going to nudge you out. And you maybe set a fire and light a fire on him and try and push him that way. With this, I think you need that confidence going into a five-game series. You don't want guys second-guessing themselves. So I think the coaching staff, it looks like, they pretty much stayed with the lines the way they want them, and they're going to have jockeying for different spots and different personnel decisions are going to be made. But I really think you got to go with your gut as a coach, and that's kind of a different experience to go through a training camp where you can control everything. You know, but at the same time, you want to give guys confidence so that they're going into this with that confidence, with the ability to say, there's nothing worse than saying, hey, if I make a mistake, I'm gone. There's no way you can play the game that way. But as a coaching staff, you want to put the best players out there. And so you have to do a good job evaluating early on and then be real honest. There's got to be a lot of dialogue, I imagine, with these players to say, hey, this is where you stand. Position, though.
We're talking to Hal Gill, Predators radio analyst, and we are getting there. We are close to some Nashville Predators hockey coming up, and Hal's coverage is brought to you by Dunkin' Donuts, and that's fitting that Hal is brought to you by Dunkin' Donuts because he knows a little something about that being from Boston. In fact, Hal, I've heard you do the character from the local Dunkin' Donuts in your hometown. Do you want to share a little bit what that guy sounds like?
You would put that on me. Yeah, every morning I go for my dunks. There's a Dunks right down the street. Well, I go to the other one. I like that one better. The lady there behind the counter is way nicer, so I go to see her. She's wicked cool, but I like my dunks. You know, being from Boston, you go in there and get an extra large dunks. That sets me up for a good day, you know.
Yeah, so this guy that you're describing could be right alongside of Casey Affleck.
Have you had the vanilla nut?
I was just going to reference the Saturday Night Live skit that Casey Affleck did. That is one of the funniest ones of all time, the crazy characters in Boston hanging out at the Dunkin' Donuts. That is good stuff. So, you know, this is interesting how you were just talking about it. I know last week there was a little flare-up, I think, in Montreal. They had some guys that were not available. You just mentioned something in Boston. They're saying unfit to play is their term. They're not revealing who has tested positive. But they did just release, the NHL did, the first 5 days of the Phase 3 testing. And they only had two positive tests for 2,600 tests administered to over 800 players. So, wow, that's pretty good so far. I mean, knock on wood, but that's encouraging. Even though I know they're probably taking a lot of precautions, there's probably, as you mentioned before, how when you haven't played in a while, there's always going to be some guys that pull a muscle here and there in the first few days of camp. That's inevitable too. So some of the unfit to play, you can't assume that they've tested positive, and obviously only two positive tests the first week. That's very encouraging.
That's surprising to me. And those numbers come out, and you have to assume the NHL is being pretty honest, because that you can come back to bite you pretty quick if you're not. So I know that the PA has been all over, the NHLPA has been all over the NHL, and they've been working together, and I can't believe how well they have been working together. Blows my mind, but they seem to have made this a safe environment. I've always said that if we can get through this and get guys healthy, get all the testing so that you're monitored and you know what's going on. Once you get into the bubble where, you know, you're in Edmonton and Toronto, these guys can get locked down. They're not going to be anywhere near anyone else, and that's when I think that's when I'll be pretty sure that this is going to take off and this is going to fly, because you can really control where everyone is and how everyone is doing. Right now, you know, you don't know. You're still testing. You're still going through on that. So it's a real positive sign that the numbers are where they are. So, fingers crossed we keep moving forward like that.
How two guys that I think are going to be big focal points of Arizona, and they've got a lot of underrated guys who are not household names but are really good young players. But the two veterans that everybody's focusing on right now are Phil Kessel and Taylor Hall. I want you to break down those two guys. Let's start with Kessel and how he does his damage, because neither of them have had the huge impact for the Coyotes that they were hoping for at this point. But as we know, everything starts over from here.
Yeah, it's Phil Kessel is, I always say, if I could be anyone, I'd probably want to be him. You know, he goes out and plays hockey.
of anyone, you would say you would want to be him. And you, of course, this is the frame of reference. Hal actually played with Phil.
Yeah, I know Phil. I played with him in the World Championships, and I've been around him. But the way he plays, he can go out there and do nothing. And at the end of the game, you'll look and you'll be like, I didn't notice him except for those two plays where he blew down the wing and scored a goal far side, and for that power play goal or assist that he had. And that's what's scary about him. You could be playing against him, and I've been there where I'm shutting this guy down. He's done nothing. And then all of a sudden he has a goal and assist. Then you go, but I shut him down. Well, he doesn't need much. He just takes, and that's where he's scary. You can put him on any line. He'll hang out, and then all of a sudden he'll score his goal. And he's got explosive speed, and he's got one of the best shots off the rush that I've ever seen. It's not always hard, but it's in stride, and I found his shot so difficult to deflect. You wait for a guy to shoot, and you just put your stick out there and tip it away. His shot was, the delivery is different, and the speed of it was just a fraction quicker than anyone else. So he's deadly in that respect. Taylor Hall is similar. He's got a crazy upside, which scares me playing against him, because if he gets his confidence and gets things going, he can be – we saw what he did in New Jersey a couple of years ago. He was – outstanding, just running that team and put up big numbers on a team that wasn't all that good. And so he's a guy, explosive speed, great hands, kind of the total package. He hasn't found a way to be on a winning team, and that's been the knock on him. But the potential is there. And so those two guys are who I'm keying on. But they have a good complement of role players, speedsters, good defensive players that can hold the fort and wait for those guys to step up and do their thing.
Last thing for me, Hal, is constructing. We discussed this when we were doing our live look-in at the practice last week, but how John Hines is going to start instilling the systems here. I would think as this week progresses, you'll probably see more work on the power play and the penalty kill. What are the key points to try to get those grinded out, ironed out, the detail that you need for those units to be successful?
It's interesting because I feel like, these guys know what they do. They're pros, and if you look at everyone, you can tell me exactly what these guys are going to do. This guy is good down low on the goal line. Duchesne should be down there. Duchesne can move up and play on the half wall. Johansson loves the half wall. I thought Kyle Turris was one of the best on the power play as the season went on. He was really good on the half wall. Of course, Yossi's got the shot from the point and can set things up. Ryan Ellis has the amazing silencer 1-2 that he can take. So, I could go on. You have all these guys and what they do. I think for the most part, it's working on mentality. And I think that if I was John Hines and the coaching staff, that's what I would be looking at is a mindset going forward of, all right, we're going to make three passes and shoot. We're not going to – the pretty play isn't always going to be there, but we're going to have to work to get those two or three passes and get a shot and then get control of rebounds and attack out of that chaos. You take the shot, everything, all hell breaks loose. You find the puck, and you make that backdoor play again and keep going at it until you score goals. And that's got to be the mindset that I think they're looking at. I think penalty kill-wise, how big was it for Ryan Ellis to come back in the lineup? I think he settled everything down. They have more of a composed, compact way of playing than they did under Laviolette. I think Hines has put that in where, they're going to protect the middle more often, give the shots from the outside. But I really think having Ryan Ellis in there kind of settled everything down and made a big difference. So I think they're at the point where they could be real effective on the penalty kill. And if that mindset gets going on the power play, we know they have the talent. It's just they need to find it. And we saw how bad it can kill you if your power play doesn't perform. And so I am worried about Arizona's penalty kill, because if our power play isn't going, their penalty kill will take advantage of it, and they're good, and they can counter, and they can score goals. So, and we've seen it more often than not, which is scary. I think this is a good time to work on all those things, but it comes down to mindset.
Last thing quickly, Hal, I know game ones are always important, but in a longer series, and especially in hockey, it changes. It goes back and forth, and you don't want to be down a game in a series, but certainly we see so many teams come back. It's not as big of a deal maybe in other sports. What about in a five-game series, in these qualifying rounds? How critical in your mind, or is it, to take game one in a five-game series? Uh-oh, did we lose Hal?
He's still
I really wanted to hear his answer.
I will say this.
Okay, there you are.
Did you lose me?
Yeah, we lost
you.
I was like,
second.
Oh, no,
yeah.
I wanted to hear his answer.
Oh, shoot. All right. Well, you know what? My answer is I don't have an answer.
Okay.
I'll be back. You should have just lost me. In a five-game series, I think more importantly than the five-game series is there's no travel. There's no, hey, we got to win this one at home, and trying to, you know, if we get one on the road during these two games, then we're back in business. That's kind of thrown out the window. So you lose one game, I don't think there's a need for an all-out panic. But if your game isn't where, you know, if you lose a game because it goes down to overtime or whatever it is, then you say, all right, we're right there. We don't have to make too many adjustments. As a coaching staff, and you lose a game and you lose it handily, do you change things around, or do you say, all right, whoa, just settle down? Because if you don't change things and it ends up being down 2-0, now you're in trouble. And so you don't have as much leeway to make changes to the way you're playing the game. And then I think the lack of travel is going to be bizarre.
Yeah.
You just sit there and wait for the next game. Everyone's rested. Everyone goes back at her, and you settle it on the ice. But I think there's going to be it's going to be a hard time for both teams to manage emotions, because it is going to be a different feel all the way around. Never mind the fact that you're going to be in a bubble. It's going to be a weird feeling anyway. Something that no one has ever gone through. So it's going to be a challenge. I think that's what's going to make it fun, is that teams are going to have to navigate through this when they don't really know what to expect.
No doubt about it. Thank you for the visit and the impression for Dunkin' Donuts. That was good stuff, Hal, and we look forward to talking to you soon and seeing you soon.
Yeah, I'm going to go get a Dak grocery now, so that gets me through the rest of the day. It's a big one.
He keeps us laughing. He's
day.
Hal Gill, a.k.a. Skillsy. Give him a follow on Twitter. He's, as you can tell, he is a fun follow, and he's always putting out funny stuff. So if you need a good laugh, just go follow Hal on Twitter. Chris Mason and Hal Gill do an unbelievable job on Twitter of just keeping you in good spirits. So many times I laugh out loud when I see some of the stuff they put out there. So, Hal, thanks for coming on. We'll come back, and we'll talk a little bit more about the return to play on the other side of Darren Donick and Chase, ESPN 102.5 The Game. Hey, you can get two tickets for two parks for the price of one. That sounds like a good deal to me. That's two tickets for the price of one. Beach Bend Splash Lagoon Water Park on sale now. Go to thegamenashville.com. Click on Beach Bend. Buy one, get one free. Do you purchase your tickets now for only $37.99? Sounds like a good deal to me. And who doesn't want to be at a water park with the temperatures the way they are right now? Man, sounds pretty good. Good stuff from Hal Gill, as always. And, you know, when I was bringing up the rosters and everybody being healthy, and he brought up the good point about the unfit to play, and I understand that's going on around the league, but I just kind of feel like by the time they're ready to get cranked up, I kind of feel like those bodies will be in place. And so it will make for some interesting you know, decisions, Willie, on John Hines and David Poyle and the staff to figure out, you know, if everybody for the most part is upright and healthy and ready to go, you do have decisions to make, because when they came to their pause and they finished on a high note with three-game winning streak, shutting out Dallas twice and beating the Canadiens 4-2, Dan Hamhuis was hurt, so that makes the decision easier. And that third D pairing wasn't Weber and Hamhuis, it was Holzer and Tenorti.
Right.
And so what's your third D pairing if everybody's ready to go? Is it back to Hamhuis and Weber? Or it did seem like they really liked Holzer and Tenorti.
More size, physicality there. You know, the analytics wasn't overwhelming in any of the four, really, but I think they like that physicality, that presence physically that both of those guys have. So I would not be surprised if that's where they go. And it looks like, based on practice, that the third pair right now is Tenorti and Holzer, and the fourth pair, more or less, is Hamhuis and Weber. But these are good questions. For example, too, I think you could make the argument that Colin Blackwell and Yakov Trenin were playing well enough to deserve to be in the mix. They were winning the job on a nightly basis at the time. But, you know, having everybody back and a guy like Austin Watson, who's had so much postseason success in his career, right, who was not having a great season, especially leading up to that, he was off. I think there's a good argument, too, that you give him the first crack. You know, he's the veteran. He's got the experience, so you start with him, and then you see what happens. And, you know, as everybody says every year, honestly, if you're going to go anywhere, everybody's going to play. Guys are going to get banged up, and you're going to need all those guys. So who starts is an important decision, for sure. But if you can get anything done, everybody's going to get their turn.
Mm-hmm. And it looks like the Jofa line may be back together as well.
They've been going with that. And
by the way, Victor Arvidsson at the very end he started on the fourth line. What was it, that last game against Dallas, the shutout? He was on the fourth line with Trenin and Turris.
They tried so many different things, mm-hmm. When you get down to it, trying to stick different guys, different spots, balance the four lines. I like the lines. I mean, how many times did we have the discussion of Kyle Turris on the wing, and could that work? It looks like they're really going to try in this summer camp to commit to that and see if it'll fly with Duchesne in the middle, Granlund on the wing, and Turris on the wing. If that works, then I think everything else looks really, really good in terms of, you know, how the lines lay out on paper. You got a guy like Kalle Yarnkrok on the fourth line.
Right.
You know, that's a line that can do some things. Colton Sissons, Austin Watson, and Kalle Yarnkrok, that's a really good line. That'd be a good third line on a lot of teams. And this is what they saw all year long on paper, right? Going into the season, they were thinking, man, we've got incredible depth at forward. And for one reason or another, they haven't gotten the production out of that group as a group that they thought they would. And it just never clicked. But if Turris fits on the wing on the second line, then I think you've got, you know, in this whole do-over, right? Start over and see what happens. That could be four really, really good lines. And if you had to make adjustments, I love putting Colin Blackwell or Yakov Trenin in there. Those guys are good young players. They just they don't have much. They don't have any playoff experience, but those guys have proven over the last several months that they belong in the league and can have big impacts on a game.
Yeah. And it looked like the line that had played so well together, that they're not going to touch that, which I think is smart.
Oh, definitely not.
Bonino and Craig Smith and Grimaldi, right?
Oh, that's been their bread and butter line all year.
Don't mess with that.
That's
right?
The one line that they would not mess with, right?
Nope. For good reason, because all they did was produce all year.
All year.
So who's got the best chance, in your opinion, to come back and have a different second half to the season, so to speak, even though it's not really a second half, but a different chapter to the rest of this season.
You got to do it in a hurry. I would, first of all, before we get to that, I'm still, did your jaw drop like mine did when you saw that tweet that the NHL put out there over all these tests that they did? They only got two positive tests, 800 players. Mm-hmm. That's really encouraging.
Yep.
If they'd have said they had 20 or 25, I'd have said, okay, you know, not too bad. Two?
Yeah.
I never thought it could be that low. But
I wouldn't have thought it either.
That's encouraging, and as Hal said, I think if they can get through this week and get everybody into those hub cities, then I think if you can start at that level where you have very, very few people recovering, then you got a great chance to get through this with everybody, in theory, being in that bubble where you're not going to mix with a lot of other people. You're going to be around other people that have tested negative, and then you just go to work. So I think that's good.
Yep. So how would you answer who has the best chance to have a different chapter to their season with the return to play?
We've kicked this around several times. I keep coming back to the same guy. I think it's Victor Arvidsson.
That's okay. I just wanted to make sure. Yeah, you've said that before.
Yeah.
You know, Chase has said Johansson, and you've said Victor Arvidsson.
And the two kind of go hand in hand, right? Because, as we said, too, this is another debate we were having a lot during the season, was when is the explosion going to happen for Philip Forsberg? So really all three of those guys, because overall the Jofa line for all these different reasons didn't play together much, some out of necessity, some because of injury, some lack of production. If they could be something close to what they are at their peak, imagine what that could mean. Just imagine that.
But couldn't you say that you could make the case that Philip Forsberg was playing, I don't want to say red hot, but he was pretty hot going into the pause.
He was starting to. You know, he was getting more assists. Remember, he went through the entire month of February without a goal.
Right.
Which was un-Philip-like.
But didn't he have like three in the last four going into the pause?
He was starting to come on. He was starting to come on. And I kept – remember, I made the bold prediction. He'll still get to 30, and you guys were thinking I was crazy. And I don't know if he would have gotten it. He would have had to have a huge month to get to that. But he's a guy that can score in both. And that's a line that can carry you, that they essentially went through the whole season without that line ever really getting a chance to play very much together. But Arvidsson is, to me, he's such a big, big key to that. If he can get that gear back with the layoff, start healthy, find that gear, it adds a dimension. He just wasn't scoring much, if at all, on the rush. And he's a guy, think about the number of times you've seen Ryan Johansson flip a pass up in the air with Victor Arvidsson streaking down the right wing and just saying, almost like you would throw your Frisbee out to your dog. You know, you've seen the Twitter, Chris Mason's got the dogs at his house where he fires the Frisbee, and he just knows no matter how far he throws it, that dog's going to run over there and catch it. It's the same thing with Victor Arvidsson. You just loop that pass up in the air, and you say, go get it. He's going to win the race. He's going to win the battle with the defenseman. That element wasn't there as much this year. He just didn't have that gear to be able to score in that fashion. He was still fighting and getting into the dirty areas and finding a way to score some goals, but it just not at the level that we know he can do. So that to me is there's a lot of upside there. There's a lot of untapped upside that they haven't had this season. That is, you know, that could be a huge factor.
So you went with Victor Arvidsson. Chase went with Ryan Johansson. I went with Pekka-Rinne, and I just kind of feel like this break will be really good for him. I do feel like they're going to start with him. I think he's going to, in my opinion, play game one just because of all the experience. You can't take away, 89 postseason games in between the pipes, and he's got tons of experience. I think the break will be really good for him, and that will be my answer. What I think is interesting is none of us mentioned Matt Duchene, and I'd be curious your thoughts on what you think maybe the break can do for Matt Duchene coming out against the Coyotes. Because I would say to this point, you know, he had not had the season he was looking for in his first year with the Preds. I think that's fair to say.
Agreed. I think his chemistry with Mikhail Granlund grew over the time of the season. I think they fit together well. Turris is such a huge key with those two guys. That line, I mean, over the last several years, we've talked about if you have the Joffre line, who's your second line? That's the whole reason that they went out and got Duchene to begin with, right? Is to give you that linchpin guy centering the second line, the dynamic player. And this is another chance, right, to have that happen. I think if you look at the overall talent for the Predators against the Coyotes, I think you find yourself saying player for player, there's more talent, definitely experienced talent, on the Predators' side. And that's not any slight at all on Arizona, because they've got a lot of really good young players that, like, I don't know how many people know much about Jacob Chychrun or Clayton Keller, right? These are guys that are going to be good for a long time and are still ascending. And if they arrive from August 2nd through 6th, then that could be trouble for the Predators. But, you know, they're not quite as deep yet. They're building a lot. But my point is the Predators' depth, they have a lot of different guys who could have a couple of big games in a five-game series. And I think Duchene is certainly a guy. If Duchene's playing his best, could he have three great games in a row where all of a sudden you're looking up and go, Duchene just won the game for us? Absolutely. Right? I think that could do wonders for him.
I was watching last night on NHL Network. They, by the way, they replayed the Stanley Cup final. One of the games with the Penguins and Preds. I think it was, I don't remember what game they showed, because I was just watching the lead up to that. It was the, you know, what was the show, Road to the Stanley Cup or whatever. And it was the reason it sparked something Hal said is, you know, in that after they win game four here and it's season, or the series is even up at two, and so far it's gone to the home teams. Peter Laviolette stood up in the room. They show that, you know, the locker room, and he's like, still got to get one in Pittsburgh. And, you know, Pekka gets up. He had the chain, and he was going to have to give it to somebody else. Remember, that was the theme that year, the dog chain. And so it was a dog on a bone. Is that right? Is that what they're saying? And so Pekka said, that's right, boys, we got to get one in Pittsburgh. And so how, you know, talking about, like, there's not going to be any of that discussion. You know, that's just so weird to, you know, you always think about, well, you got to get one. If you don't have the series advantage at home, then you're going to be talking about, well, you got to get one at their place. You know, and it's like none of that is going to be in the cards. Like none of that talk.
Right.
Travel.
You know,
that stuff
travel,
is not
the
in the cards.
The travel. Think about, you know, all the time we spent going, you know, from the bus to the airport, on the plane, getting home, going back, you know, in a seven-game series.
Right.
Especially sometimes in the Western Conference where the cities are spread pretty far apart, right, all the places we've been. But I was wondering this, and I don't know the answer, but my theory might be, because you were asking about winning the first game, do you think it increases the chances that somebody comes back from a 2-0 deficit? You know, of the eight series that are going on, they're all five-game series in that qualifying round. There's no travel. I think there's going to be a team that falls behind 2-0 and then comes back and sweeps the next three.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know why that – could that be possible? Sure. I don't know. It's going to be interesting to see, what, like you said, the dynamic of not having to travel. No home ice advantage, no travel.
Yeah, it's different. It'll be different than any history, right?
Yeah,
this will be the first time in history that they're done like this. Adam Vingan in The Athletic did the numbers, right? And this stands to reason. This is more mathematics than it is really anything else. Like, if you just think about it, if you win the first game, you have an advantage, in any series. You just have to win less games than the other team. So percentages are in your favor. So in the history of best of seven, the winner of game one wins about 69% of the time. In a five-game series, the winner of game one wins about 83% of the time. But this is going to be a different five-game series than what we've seen before because of all the reasons we just said. So I don't know. The game one winner is going to feel great, but you just can't panic. You can't panic. Of all the series, I'll guarantee you there's going to be multiple series where the team that loses game one wins the series.
So you're calling for comebacks, a lot of comebacks.
I think there'll be at least one.
Okay.
Where a team's down games 0-2. To none, comes back and wins.
All right. We'll remember that. I don't think that's crazy. I mean, it's not a crazy notion at all, but I'll be curious to see if that indeed plays out. All right, we'll come back, and a prominent name in the NFL has said he's out. He's hanging up his cleats. He's retiring. We'll tell you who that is, and also the Braves have a little announcement too. They're removing a sign from Truist Park. We'll get into all that to wrap up Monday's show next on Darren Donick and Chase, ESPN 102.5 The Game. Looks like the Atlanta Braves, Chase's beloved Braves, Chase is out this week. They are going to remove a chop-on sign, Willie, from Truist Park. They still have not made a decision on the tomahawk chop chant, but the sign chop-on is going to be removed from Truist Park. What do you think about that little news? But by the way, we should have somebody on to talk about the Braves tomorrow on the program. Looks like we will have Kelly Krull. Is that right, Marquise? Is that?
Yes, just confirming a time, but okay. It will more than likely be 1:00 tomorrow.
Okay, all right. So we'll talk about the Braves tomorrow. But the news today is the chop-on sign is going to be taken out of Truist Park.
Different way of thinking. Right? Everybody's thinking differently on these things, and rightfully so. What's the level of acceptable? Everybody's going to have to make up their decision. I like the proactive side that they're going to, they're doing this, right? They're finding where that level is. I know this, and I think you do as well. We've been to a lot of Braves games over the last 20 years or something, and that the chant is the one that they're really going to have to decide, because that's been a big part of their park experience, right? That's how the fans get into it. Every team has got something that their fans get into, and for them, that's it. So that'll be hard to part with, right? If they decide, and it'll be for the right reasons that they decide not to do it, if they do, but that will change. What the feel of, and the identity of a Braves game is like, right? So if you're going to do that, then do you just go ahead and change your nickname altogether, right? Which, that's sort of the chain of thinking that you start going down.
Oh, there's no question about it. I don't know how you could remove chop on, but keep the tomahawk chop chant. Right? That doesn't seem like they kind of go hand in hand, don't they? I mean,
you can make that argument, without a doubt.
It's kind of weird to remove one and keep the other, at least in my opinion. But what's interesting is going down to Atlanta and having some of the discussions that we have with people, it didn't seem like the Braves were going to change their name. And I don't, but it is interesting. But yet they're doing other things, so I don't know. Although when we went to Cleveland last week when you were out, Matt Lodi told us that he kind of feels like the Indians are going that way, that a name change may be coming.
I've sensed that. I think there is a lot of momentum towards that, and Cleveland does have other team names that they had, the Naps and the Spiders, right? They could go way back and at least have some roots to go to that nickname. The Braves going back to their days in Boston and Milwaukee, right? They've been the Braves for a long, long time, since the very, very beginning. And so I'm curious, how would lifelong Braves fans feel about it? Because as we said, I think there's a difference between the Redskins and the Braves, Chiefs, etc. Right? I do think in my mind, but that doesn't mean I'm not a Native American, and you know they and then you get into Blackhawks and things like that, right? It's the NCAA went through this, and now it looks like you know it is now up for discussion with every team that has that.
Mm-hmm. And the other piece of news was it looks like AB 84, Antonio Brown, is looks like all signs are pointing towards him hanging it up, saying he is peace out. He's going to call it a career. He tweeted out, "It is time to walk away. I'm done. Everything in the I've done everything in the game. At this point, the risk is greater than the reward. Thank you, everyone, who've been part of this journey. I sincerely thank you for everything. Life goes on. 84. I came. I saw. I conquered. Mission complete." So a lot of people are saying all signs are pointing towards Antonio Brown being done. I don't know if it's more about him really calling it a career or if the phone has just stopped ringing for Antonio Brown.
I don't know which one was ringing.
Do what?
I don't think the phone was really ringing.
No, I know. That's what I'm saying. I'm thinking this is kind of like a forced retirement. If somebody called him right now, would he still be headed into retirement? I tend to not believe that. I just kind of feel like he's looking around going, do I hear anything? And then he hears
crickets.
And I think he's like, okay, well, I guess nobody's interested in my services anymore. And so I'm just going to call it a career. But it's Antonio Brown.
He's not the first that has had to come to that conclusion if that's how it went down.
No, it is not. You know what that music means? Today is in the books. Enjoy the rest of your day. Be safe. We want you back with us tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. We'll see you then.